What's up, Beardos? You're listening to episode 176 of The Bearded Vegans.
Basically, our whole philosophy boils down to don't be a jerk.
Let me answer the question first by not answering the question. I really hope people didn't tune in to hear us talking about beards.
Beards.
What does that mean, Paul?
The big beans and the big brown ripple.
Who knows, Andy? I don't know.
Welcome to the show. I'm Paul.
And I'm Andy.
And we are The Bearded Vegans, a podcast featuring a dissection of all things vegan.
If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find all of our previous episodes at thebeardedvegans.com, and you can always reach us by emailing thebeardedvegans@gmail.com.
In today's episode, we're going to talk about what we've been eating, interview Jake Conroy about the pitfalls of advocating for individual change, and then go over the news. Andy, what's going on?
So, Paul, you know, two episodes ago, we kept teasing that we had a really great guest for the follow-up episode, and that interview had been completed and done and everything, so it's not like the schedule got pushed around because of anything like that. But we just sort of felt like that the interview would actually work better at this point in our series as opposed to last week. So we're going to make that happen. And because this is a full-length episode, often the interviews go to the shorter quote-unquote mini-episodes, which usually are pretty long anyway. So we are going to talk about what we've been eating. And then normally we put the interview at the end of an episode. We're going to play that interview, even though it is like a lengthy 50-minute long interview. It's a great interview, by the way. And then afterwards, we're going to talk about some news because I think the news relates to the interview, and it'll be easier to talk about the news once we have heard the interview and maybe have a little bit of discussion about some of the ideas presented within. So switching it up today.
Andy, I'm excited about a certain someone that's represented in our news story.
Honestly, one of the main reasons why I wanted to talk about it is because I know we have a great impression from you coming up.
Okay. Andy, also, you know, it's episode 176. That means we got the mailbag a-coming, as you have written down in these show notes. So in four short episodes from now, we'll be doing our, I was about to say biannually, but that is terribly inaccurate. I don't know what the word for every 10 means. Decannually, something like that. Probably something like that. Every 10 episodes, we got our mailbag episode where we will be answering your questions that you've submitted. So if you have any questions that you are burning to ask us, feel free to send those in. Best place, probably the email, thebeardedvegans@gmail.com. But I'm sure we'll also be putting out the call on the Instagram as well. So no question too big, too small. Just try not to make it too medium, but I guess we'll allow it if it is.
Paul, you're changing up the standards. You used to say nothing was too medium, and now you're shying people away from the too medium questions? All right. Okay, so that's the mailbag. Get those in.
You know my saying, Andy, go big or go small. No medium.
Great. Okay. Also, Paul, we announced this last episode, but in case you missed it, we are back on track with episode transcripts, and there's a transcript for this episode available in the show notes right this very second. So that'll be happening every full-length episode, every other episode. Really excited about that. And then the final announcement is that this coming weekend, I will be speaking at the Nashville Veg Fest. I will once again be joining the wonderful, magnificent JL Fields. We'll be doing a panel about food and body shaming, and really excited to bring this panel discussion to Nashville. So coming out for that, I believe the time for the panel is noon. So get there early, get your seats, and let's have a fun time together. Let's have a good discussion. I know we've been refining what we're going to be talking about and our specialties and whatnot. So should be a good time at the Nashville Veg Fest this coming weekend, April 6th, 2019. Paul, what have you been putting in that beautiful mouth of yours?
So, Andy, I love protein, and I actually got a chance to try some new products from this company called NuZest. That's NuZEST. I might say the best way to spell new, NU. and yeah, they basically, they wanted to, they asked if they could send us some products and have us talk about it. So we were like, sure, we will give it an honest review on the podcast. So I got sent a plethora of New Zest products, and their big thing is clean, lean protein. And there's like little subtitles. It says clean because it's 100% plant-based with no fillers, lean because it's low carb, and protein because every cell needs it. So if that's the type of thing that you're into, I would say definitely check them out. I got the protein powder, which I will say, as someone who intakes possibly more protein than I would ever need, the protein powder itself was really good. It's like super, it was very creamy. It blended very nicely, and it's very low calorie with a high protein content. Is 90 calories for 19 grams of protein, which I think is pretty hard to come by. So if that's your thing, definitely check out that protein powder. But then they also sent me these protein bars, and as someone who is extremely busy in my life, I would say I definitely utilize protein bars a lot. And there's definitely in the protein bar community, I would say there's a big divide between having the ones that are like candy bar protein bars. Like, I would say, not that I eat them anymore, but the Clif Builder bars you were essentially just eating a chocolate bar, like a chocolate candy bar. And then there's like the super healthy ones that typically don't taste very good. I'm not going to name any brands, but I feel like New Zest is like the perfect divide between the two, where it does not taste like I'm eating a candy bar, but it still tastes good and it still has the nutrients that I want. So I tried the vanilla almond bar, which was a protein bar, the cacao coconut bar, and those were both great. But then the one that surprised me was they also sent this multivitamin bar, which I guess is less of a protein bar. It still has 5 grams of protein.
Ooh, but it's does more it taste just like chewing a multivitamin, Paul?
Well, surprisingly, even though it's like chock full of a lot of green stuff, and stuff that typically I would associate with something not tasting very good, it also, I think one of the big ingredients is dates. And so it has a very strong date taste, and I do love dates. So that's actually been my favorite one, this multivitamin bar, because I have not eaten a multivitamin. I've not taken a multivitamin in some time, which is probably not good. So this was a great way to get my multivitamins in a way that tastes good. So if any of this piques your interest, I would definitely suggest checking out New Zest. And you can find them at newzest-usa.com. That leads me to believe that you can only get it in the USA. So if you're an international listener, I apologize.
Paul, I'm glad you're the one that received this package, because I hate date-based protein bars or bars in general. I'm just so over it. I used to, you know, whenever I like bite into a bar and I'm just like, ugh, dates and nuts. Like, come on, give me something new. So I'm glad that you like them, because it feels like not something that would super appeal to me. Also, I'm kind of over anyone describing food as quote unquote clean. Like, I feel like that's just something that really aids to a lot of unhealthy eating habits, this obsession with like clean eating. But in general, I'm glad you had a good experience.
Thank you, Andy. Thank you. Anyways, Andy, now this episode is all out of order. Usually you talk about what you've been eating first. This time I did. So, Andy, what are you eating?
Well, Paul, being in Southern California, spending a lot of time in Los Angeles the last couple of weeks, I caught wind of this new all-vegan market in LA called Besties Vegan Paradise. And what intrigued me about them was that I was told that they only carry products from fully vegan companies. So if it's, you know, a company that like a Sweet Earth or something that makes, you know, vegan breakfast burritos, but they also make non-vegan breakfast burritos, they will not carry any of their products. And some might say that that's super limiting, to which I would agree. But also, I feel like that's kind of cool. Like, I appreciate someone taking that sort of stance. And I think it is kind of nice for those that are trying to only support fully vegan companies, that they do have a place to go to find products like that. And it was just fun for me to walk around and be like, oh, I didn't realize that this company only made vegan stuff. This company only made vegan stuff. Found a couple new things I had never seen before. And the thing that I decided to pick up was this product from Bee Leaf, B-E space L-E-A-F, which I'm assuming is some sort of play on believe. They make a vegan fried egg and a couple other things like that. What I picked up was their wasabi jerky. So it's just meatless vegan jerky, wasabi shredded style. And the ingredients are mainly soybean fiber. And there's like a little sugar, soy sauce, wasabi powder, etc. in it. And it just comes in like a big bag of like shredded soy protein fibers of some kind. And I was curious because I love wasabi, but I was like, do I really want a giant bag of wasabi to chew on while I'm driving? Paul, one time I did a wasabi off at Mia's, which is a sushi place that we both love. And it was like one of those things where like in the cartoons where like the neighbors keep building their fences higher and higher and higher, like right next to each other, and ended up with like an inch stack of wasabi on top of a piece of sushi.
Oh.
And I ate it. Oh, and that's when I realized that there, I think that there's like a, it's not like with hot sauce where like the more you add, like the hotter it is. I feel like there's sort of a limit to the burn of wasabi. And I love the burn of, I'm not a huge hot sauce fan, but I love the burn of wasabi where it feels like you're, it's like reaching up into your brain and like squeezing it and like shaking it around and then let's go like really quickly. I love that so much. Huge fan of that. And I learned there's like a roof to how much that burn can happen. But then also when you just have like a mouthful of wasabi paste, that's like you're just trying to clean it out from your gums and you're swishing your, it's not a pleasant experience at all. So I'm wary of eating something that is just all super wasabi-esque. And I was happy to report that the wasabi flavor is very light. And it just, it kind of tastes like there used to be, or maybe there still are, these like wasabi soy almonds from Diamond. And they taste kind of like that. I am so into this stuff. I'm sad that I didn't get more bags of it because it is amazing. I got to give you some if there's any. There won't be any left by the time I see you. But you, I feel like you would be really into it. It's like very, it's like shredded. So you're not like tearing off pieces of it. You just sort of reach in and grab a little handful like it's snuff or something like that. But it is so good. I am so into it. I will definitely be buying more of this stuff in the future.
Andy, I love wasabi so much, and one of my all-time favorite snacks is wasabi peas. Mm. But maybe I just have like an enhanced sensitivity to wasabi. But like if I eat, if because I'll be eating them like a few at a time, and then if I eat just one too many at the same time, it's like my whole every like all my senses just like shut down for a second, and it's like I can't like I can't see for a second, and I like can't hear anything, and then I'm like, oh, I'm back, okay, and that's what happens when I eat too much wasabi.
I live for that feeling.
The straight edge high eating too much wasabi.
It's so good. This stuff I don't think could give you that feeling. Like the wasabi is like very gentle, and it's like it's overall like a little sweet, and it's just it's really good. It's really good. All right, Paul. You know, normally this would be the time of the show where we thank our latest Patreon donors, but we are recording this mere minutes after we recorded last week's episode because of this huge drive I have coming up preparing ahead. So we have no new Patreon donors to thank at this very second. But if you do want to support the podcast, you can just go to thebeardedvegans.com/beardo and you'll find a link to our Patreon and PayPal and our web store and all that good stuff. And it helps keep the podcast going, helps keeping the transcriptions like the one available for this episode, keeps those going as well. So thank you to anyone that does support us.
Yeah, thank you for your I know we only thank the new people every week, but thank you for all you for your continued support.
Yeah, huge shout out to the people that like signed up when we first launched this thing almost a year ago and are still going. Like, super appreciate that. Of course, do not donate if in any way it's a hardship to you and in your life, but we definitely appreciate all the support that we do get. Okay, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to play this interview that I did with Jake Conroy, who is now going by The Cranky Vegan on YouTube and Instagram, and I believe Facebook as well. The main reason why I initially reached out to Jake, who's someone I've been following his work for a while, I think he has a lot of really interesting ideas and says a lot of stuff that I think the vegan movement as a whole, if there ever was one, should be listening to and considering at the very least. And specifically because I saw Jake make this post when the whole Steve-O thing happened, which of course we did a whole episode on that. But this whole Steve-O thing happened and Jake basically made this post. It's like, can we stop caring if individuals are vegan and focus on like strategic campaigning instead? And I thought that would make a really interesting follow-up in addition to the Steve-O episode. And even the health ex-vegan health episode that we did as well. And sort of, you know, we by doing these episodes, we sort of fall into that trap of really dissecting why everyone's not vegan and all of those things. But I thought it'd be really good to bring this interview in to sort of like zoom out and look at the bigger picture, like the grander scale of everything. And so we talk a lot about that in the interview. We also talk all about Jake's time involved in the Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty campaign, the Shack campaign, which eventually did lead to him being incarcerated for a period of time. And that whole story of that campaign, I think, is pretty phenomenal. And so we're including that in the beginning of the interview as well. So after the interview, we will talk a little bit about some news and maybe even discuss some of the ideas presented in the interview as well. So with that said, let's get right to it and let's get into it with Jake Conroy, the cranky vegan. Jake, thank you for talking with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, you know, normally I start the interviews, I always ask people, like, what led you to veganism? But, like, I really want to talk all about activism today. So I think I'll actually start by asking, what brought you to activism? Were you an activist before you became a vegan? Like, what did that kind of look like for you?
Before I was an activist and before I was vegan, I was into hardcore and punk rock music. And that got me interested in activism and animal rights in, like, the early, mid-90s. And I'd moved out from the East Coast to Seattle. And I don't know, there's just something that was like, I just knew like, oh, this is something I needed to do. I needed to go vegan and I needed to become an activist. Like, veganism for me just wasn't going to be enough. And so I went to Burger King. I had a double bacon cheeseburger with Swiss cheese, mushrooms, french fries, and a chocolate milkshake. And then I was like, that's it. And then I'm done. And the next day I went vegan. And then, you know, a few months after that, I found my way into an animal rights group in Seattle and just went from there.
So, like, what did your earliest activism look like?
I worked with an organization called Northwest Animal Rights Network, which is still around today and I still work with in Seattle. And it was this really interesting group of like people had been doing activism since the 80s and then mixed with like myself and a handful of other like young, you know, hardcore punk rock kids that didn't want to be told what to do. And all of us just kind of like working together to do a lot of like vegan outreach protests, one-off protests, you know, like you'd be at the butcher shop one day, the McDonald's the next day, the circus the next day. We started doing some civil disobedience and eventually like we started doing some more targeted campaigning to shut down fur stores and things like that.
And did you have any, I don't know how, I want to talk at some point sort of how you classify what victories are and what winning is and all that. But in those early days, did you achieve anything that you would consider to be a victory?
Yeah. I mean, on a personal level, for sure. Like, I think just getting to spend time with people that have been doing activism, you know, for 10 years, longer than I had since the 80s, like, and learning from them and having them kind of be mentors, I think was in a sense like a victory. I think becoming vegan and getting involved in activism without really anyone else in my life doing that also feels like a little bit of like a personal victory. But in terms of like campaigning, like we shut down, you know, a couple fur salons in the greater Seattle area. That was a pretty big deal at the time, you know. Fur just wasn't that popular in Seattle, so there wasn't a lot of fur targets, but we shut down what we could. That felt good. And you know, there's little things here and there that we did that felt like we were changing our community for the better. And that felt like tangible, real-world victories that I think are really important.
Very cool. And so I definitely want to talk about, you know, your views on activism today, what's going on in the movement, like, currently. But I think it'd be really important to talk about the Shack campaign. I feel like there's so many lessons to be learned from that. It's pretty just an amazing story in general and something that you were a crucial part of. So tell us all about the Shack campaign and the history of that.
Yeah, it's a long story. It takes me about 3 or 4 hours. No, I'm just kidding. Basically, the Shack campaign started in England. There was... basically three people that were kind of similar to, you know, that they had been doing these protests like in front of the butcher shops and the McDonald's and the fur stores. And they wanted to switch all that up and do some more focused pressure campaigning or targeted campaigning by picking one place and protesting it until they won, and no matter how long it took. And for them, the victory was to shut the place down. So they went after a place called Consort Beagle Breeders, which was a place that bred dogs for vivisection. In 12 months, they shut that place down. They moved on to a cat farm that bred cats for vivisection. They shut that place down in 18 months. They shut down a rabbit farm in 7 days. They shut down a primate breeding facility in England in 12 months. So this is really exciting. Like, they were getting all these victories one after the other, but they wanted to pick something that was larger and bigger and would have more of an impact on the vivisection industry. So they picked this laboratory called Huntington Life Sciences, which is the third largest contract research organization in the world, meaning they didn't make any new products. They just tested all these products on animals for other companies that would hire them as like a third party. And they basically bankrupted them within a year. But in order to survive, the laboratory moved all their finances from England to the United States, where they assumed there really wasn't a strong animal rights movement. So I had been watching these breeder campaigns, you know, against Consort and Hillgrove and so forth, from Seattle. And that really, they really inspired me a lot. You know, and this was before the internet. Like, if you wanted to see what was going on in England, you had to get someone with like, you know, a VHS player to record video and then put it in international mail and send it to you to Seattle. And then when it gets to Seattle, you have to transfer it from PAL format to NTSC format, England format to US format, and then watch it on a VCR with your friends. And like, this is how you shared information and saw what was going on in the animal rights movement, you know, around the world. And so they had these like amazing videos of them like breaking down walls and liberating animals and shutting these places down. It was so inspiring. I wanted to do more of that. And that's how we really started pushing for these campaigns in Seattle against the fur stores. So when the laboratory moved their finances to the United States, there was a push to open U.S. chapter of the group in England, which was called SHAC, or Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty. So in 2001, I moved back to the East Coast, met up with some folks there, and we started SHAC USA, or Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty USA. And the beauty part of the campaign was that it was a grassroots, no-nonsense, no-compromising campaign. And it was run very horizontally, meaning that there weren't really any leaders saying, you need to do this and you need to do that. It was just the grassroots animal rights movement in the United States all pulled together to protest against this laboratory. And it wasn't just horizontally organized, you know, across the United States, but it was going on in like 18 different countries around the world. Everyone self-organizing themselves into these communities and these movements and organizations to shut this place down. So it was really beautiful. And the other really important thing about it was that we used this idea of tertiary targeting, which basically means like, instead of protesting against just the laboratory, we protested against every company that was associated with the laboratory. Because a company like a laboratory needs certain things to stay open, right? It needs bank accounts, it needs insurance companies, it needs internet, it needs food in their cafeteria, toilet paper in their bathrooms. And it was a publicly traded company, so you could buy and sell shares, and it had a board of directors. It had so many different targets, and all of these targets didn't need the laboratory for those companies to succeed, but that laboratory needed those companies to be profitable and operate. So one by one, we got all these companies to pull their contracts and cancel contracts with the laboratory to essentially like financially cripple them. So it was really exciting. We got like the world's largest banks to no longer offer a bank account to the laboratory. We got the world's largest insurance companies to no longer insure the laboratory. We got the world's largest auditors saying they wouldn't do any auditing services for the laboratory. They're internet providers. We got them kicked off the New York Stock Exchange. We got, you know, people to stop delivering food and toilet paper. I mean, we just crippled this company. And by we, I mean, like, it wasn't like the three of us sitting in our office. It was like this horizontal movement of grassroots, no-nonsense activists and individuals just from the communities around the world fighting against this one target. And at the height of the beginning of the campaign, you know, you could buy a share of this laboratory for about $30. And at the height of our campaign, it was only worth a few pennies. So it was really exciting.
So when you say you were protesting against these tertiary companies, what kind of tactics were you using?
That was really up to the individual. We had a strict policy of no physical violence against any animals, human or otherwise. But besides that, if it was something you felt would help shut down this laboratory, then we would support your right to engage in those activities to a certain extent. Didn't mean we agreed with them or we would participate in them, but we would publish what you're up to on our webpage. So our webpage, and the webpages were kind of new back then. This was 2001. So, you know, organizing things over the internet was kind of like this, you know, uncharted territory. So we had this webpage that operated kind of like a clearinghouse of information. You could find everything and anything about the laboratory and the people that work there and the people associated with it. But a big piece of it was also we operated like a very opinionated news source. So, you know, say you decided to have a protest where you lived and, you know, you'd send us an email and you would write, you know, oh, we stood outside the office for 5 minutes and held signs and chanted, we'd put it up on our webpage. If someone then would like smashed out a window or broken and rescued animals, we'd put that up on our webpage to let people know what was going on around the country with the campaign. So people wrote letters, they sent faxes, they signed petitions, people did demonstrations outside of offices associated with the laboratory. But we also felt that the people who are making decisions about the laboratories worked inside the offices. So we felt that doing demonstrations inside of these office buildings was also appropriate and necessary. So to that end, people would do like run-ins into office buildings and do disruptions in there. But we also felt that the animals in the laboratories were in those cages 24 hours a day. So therefore, the people making those decisions should also be held accountable 24 hours a day. So we would do home demonstrations sometimes, you know, on the weekends or after work, that type of thing. And that's a controversial tactic for sure, but it is for the most part legal. So, we would do demonstrations at people's homes. Other people decided they wanted to do more extra legal or illegal activities. So people would do civil disobediences, lock themselves to things, try to shut places down that way. Other people would engage in like vandalism. So maybe spray painting buildings or breaking windows. And other people would engage in liberations, which would be, you know, breaking into facilities and rescuing animals or damaging equipment, that type of thing. It was a really wide gamut of tactics, which was really exciting. It was also a bit terrifying because when you do a horizontally organized campaign, you obviously aren't in charge of anyone. So anyone's free to do whatever they want. So in a sense, like you're very excited that everyone's participating in the way that they want to participate, but also you're like holding your breath that no one's going to do anything like really terrible that then you have to like decide what to do with, which I guess is kind of the pitfalls of having a horizontally led, a horizontally organized campaign. But for the most part, it was really exciting. It was super inspiring and really empowering for people to just realize the power that they had as individuals and as small groups of what we all could accomplish, which is taking down one of the world's largest laboratories of its kind.
And the campaign seemed to be so successful and it caught the attention of the U.S. government, right?
It did, yeah. I mean, the short version of the story is basically, you know, we were taking down the world's largest pharmaceutical companies, the world's largest financial institutions, getting them to do what we want. Just like kids running through the streets causing problems. We're basically like affecting like who gets traded on the New York Stock Exchange and how like trillion-dollar industries are operating. And they were pissed. So basically they went to the governments in England and the United States and said, you need to do something about this. Otherwise, we are gonna pull our industries out of your companies and or excuse me, out of your countries. Well, same thing, I suppose. but money talks, and so the government reacted. And pushed really hard to stop all of us, which looked like a lot of different tactics. You use a lot of tactics, you get a lot of tactics used against you, I suppose. But the corporations hired public or private investigators. They hired lawyers to try to stop us. And then the United States government and also the government in England went after the activists in those countries, you know, really, really heavily.
For those that don't know, what was the result of them going after the activists?
Sure. In the United States, we were being followed. Sometimes we were having 24-hour surveillance outside of our office, which is also our home. We had our phones tapped. The government recorded 550 90-minute cassette tapes worth of phone conversations, not just talking to activists, but loved ones, attorneys, friends, partners. They use pen tracers, which is basically a device they put on your internet to monitor which web pages you're going to. We found out that we were, I think, the first group of people the United States government sent to our computers to try to get like keylogging software onto our computer so they could figure out our passwords to our encryption. They were digging through our garbage. They were having the mailman hold all of our mail so they could photocopy it. They eventually raided our home, took everything that wasn't nailed down. And then they eventually came for us and arrested all of us. They arrested six people or charged six people in the organization, which became the Shack 7 in the United States, and tried us on a variety of different charges. But the main charge we were all given was the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, which is now the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And what the law states is that if you cross a state line to disrupt a business that uses animals and you do more than $10,000 worth of physical damage to the property, then they can essentially try you as domestic terrorist. So the law was written in the late 80s, early 90s, basically to try to prevent people from driving around the country and breaking into fur farms and laboratories, rescuing animals, smashing cages, smashing lab equipment, that type of thing. So for our case, they went out on a limb and tried to imply that we crossed state lines using the internet and that we did more than $10,000 worth of economic damage because we affected the share price of the laboratory. And that was one of the multiple charges they gave us. We took it to trial. We fought it. It was about a month-long jury trial, and we eventually lost. And then we were all found guilty and sentenced to prison. And I was sentenced to 4 years in federal prison, which I did in two prisons in Southern California. And then I was put onto 3 years of probation after that.
So I guess the positive spin on that is that if the campaign was not so successful, they clearly would not have used so much force to try and shut you down. I guess the negative is, do you feel like they were like making an example of you and scaring other activists away from trying to engage in those type of campaigns?
Yes to all of that. I think oftentimes people's rebuttal to the Shack campaign is, well, you didn't win. It didn't work. And I think the answer is the opposite. It worked too well. We were so successful that the government classified us as the biggest threat to the security of the nation, which is ludicrous. And we were the largest investigation of the FBI of the time. Like, they went after us harder than anyone else in the country, which is, again, totally insane. And to me, that signifies like what we were doing had so much power and so much ability to affect change and affect the things that they worry about and care about, which is capitalism and money and industry. And, you know, a bunch of like ragtag radical kids running through the streets had such an impact on that they did everything they possibly could to try to stop us. And I think they knew that they had to throw as many weird and charges and twists and turns. And like, you know, they charged us with laws that had never been tried this way before, just to see what would stick and hope that they could get one or two of them to stick, that we would all be found guilty. And that, yes, that we would, our prosecution would scare off others from engaging in this type of activity. And to a certain extent, I think it worked, unfortunately. I do think people are weary for some reason of going to prison. Just kidding. Prison sucks. And so people got scared, and I don't blame them. It was a terrible situation. It was awful. But I think that, like, that was a desperate attempt of the government trying to scare the shit out of particularly animal rights activists. From engaging in activism that works.
And so I've seen other criticisms of that camp, not that campaign specifically, but I guess sort of the more targeted campaigns in general, which is, even if they are successful and you shut down one lab or one business or one fur farm, whatever it might be, that if the consumer demand is still there, that more are just going to pop up. So why do that? Why not just engage in convincing the world to go vegan, because if there's a vegan world, they're not buying fur, they're not buying pharmaceuticals that have been tested on animals. And I'm wondering what your response is to that. Why not? Why not just go out and just convince everybody to go vegan? I say that as if that's like an easy thing to do, of course. But like why not focus on that or figure out the best way to do that as opposed to finding one specific corporation or lab and targeting them?
I think there's huge answers to all those questions. But let's see if we can squeeze them all in. I think that the idea that you're targeting one corporation and that's it, I think is like kind of a very like base level view of that type of what corporate campaigning is. I think corporations want to be as successful and powerful as they can be, but they also want the public to a certain extent to look at them and be like, hey, this is a good company. Therefore, I want to spend my money with them. So I think if you get one corporation to change or shut down, in the world of Shaq, it was to shut the place down. But a lot of corporate campaigning is about changing corporations and changing those sectors. And I think if you can get one or two of the major players to change in big ways, I think all the other ones eventually start to move with them because they want to be competitive. They want to keep up with the number one, the number two. So I do think there's value in going after just one or two companies and getting them to shift because the sectors change with that. But what I don't think the sectors really respond to is the demand side of supply and demand, particularly when it comes to veganism. There just simply is not enough power in the vegan communities, the vegan world, to affect capitalism and corporations in that way. It's just, I think it's what we want to believe, that we have this like power as individuals in the vegan movement to change the world. And it just isn't happening. I mean, we've been doing vegan outreach as a tactic. I mean, granted, in the long-term view of this, like it's not that long, but we have only been doing vegan outreach. We have been doing vegan outreach for like 40 years, 35 years. And like the numbers of vegans really haven't changed. In some places, they've gone down. But the one number that keeps getting bigger and bigger is the animals being killed every year. And that to me is the most alarming one. And that's the one I think we need to really work on changing. And if something isn't working, i.e. vegan outreach, then I think we owe it to like the animals that we're fighting for to think about adjusting our strategies and adjusting our tactics and having difficult conversations with ourselves and say, hey, like maybe what we're doing isn't working. And maybe we need to try something different. And that's a hard thing to do because no one likes to admit that they're wrong or they made a mistake. But I think we have to be honest and realistic with ourselves that like we just never will have that power, those numbers that we need to shift like literally every single fabric of life on this planet. I mean, it's not just like getting people to like stop eating animals. I mean, you are like, you have to change every little piece of your entire lives, like everything you eat, everything you wear, how you travel, the medicines you take, the entertainment you use. And that goes for vegans too. Like everything that we, you know, say is vegan and that we use still comes from the backs of animals. Like there's some animal being killed or enslaved or put into a really awful situation so that vegans can have our vegan food and so that we can have our synthetic clothing and that we can have our natural medicines. Like all of this comes at the cost of animals' lives. And so we have to like recognize like a vegan world is like a world that is just radically different. And I think it would need to be radically different before we start actually seeing it affect and change, you know, major, major portions of the global community and the global capitalism and corporatism. And like at the rate that we do vegan outreach and embrace it as a strategy, we will just never, ever, ever, ever get there. And that just makes no sense to me why we continue to embrace it so hard.
And can I actually just back it up a second? Because you said something that I feel like a lot of people might be a little shocked to hear, which was that really the amount of vegans has not grown significantly. And I think a lot of people would hear that and they go, but wait, I just keep seeing these articles that come out and it's grown by 600%, 800%, and there's quadruple the amount of vegans and all this stuff. I know that's something, those are numbers that you've been skeptical of. I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit.
Sure. I mean, I'm just a skeptic at heart. And I think my favorite one is the one that came out in 2016. There was like a Gallup poll that said there's this many vegetarians and vegans in England. And everyone's like, well, from 2006 to 2016, it was a 600% increase in vegans and vegetarians in England. That's amazing. Like, blah, blah, blah. We're winning. We're at a tipping point. But then if you go back and look at the Gallup poll from 1990, where they did the same thing and they polled how many vegetarians and vegans there were in 1990, there were more vegans and vegetarians in 1990 than in 2016. But we had lost so many of them by the time we got to 2006 and they started the polling again. So by the time we got to 2016, we were like at something like 1.95 million vegans and vegetarians in England. 600% increase in the last 10 years, but since 1990, there was like 2.1 million vegans and vegetarians. So like, yeah, I think animal rights activists and vegans, we love these numbers that, you know, inflate our communities and make it look like we're being a lot more successful than we are. To me, it does a really disservice to all of us to spread these numbers. And I get the idea of like from a public perception, like, yes, everyone wants to be on the winning team. Like, yes, let's tell everyone that vegans are growing by 600%. And like, people want to be a part of that. I get all of that. But as like an activist movement, to spread these kind of like fallacies amongst one another, I think is really damaging because it reinforces the idea that the activism we've been doing in the past is working. From 2006 to 2016, we increased our amount of vegetarians and vegans in England by 600%. So therefore, the activism we were doing then, which is predominantly like handing out flyers and talking to people and wearing weird masks and holding TVs on the street, is like, this is what's changing the world. See, it's working. But I think there's a strong argument to say that it really isn't. And I think if we're honest with ourselves about these numbers and where these numbers come from, then I think we can be a stronger movement to help, you know, non-human animals. But there's the same article like that came out, I think last year maybe, about how 8% of the U.S. population was vegan now, and everyone started reporting on it. And, you know, Mercy for Animals puts out a blog and they cite as their source of this number, like a Live Kindly blog, and Live Kindly cites like another blog, you know, and that blog cites Mercy for Animals blog. And it's just like in this continued like citing circle where there's never any actual like, you never actually get to see this report or the statistics or the numbers or the research they did to get to this 8%. But it all comes from this report from this like private company where you have to pay $3,500 to see this report, you know, to figure out the polling and how they did the statistics to get to this number. And I guarantee no one's paid $3,500 to see this report. So no one knows where, you know, it's just this number that we like to hear. You know, but 4 months later, there was a poll by the Gallup poll in the United States that came out that we're at about 2.5% vegans and vegetarians, which is like a 0.5 increase over the last 15 or 20 years. And to me, that's like the more realistic statistic and numbers and reports we should be looking at and digging into, where you can actually see their polling and how they did the report and see all that for free, and then start reassessing like where we're at as a movement. To me, that seems like a much more valuable use of our time.
And I guess the only thing that I struggle with that is, because I've also, as a podcast, we've been very skeptical of those numbers, but it feels like, you know, I've only been vegan 11 years, but from my 11 years as a vegan, it feels like there's progress being made. And I think when I reflect on that, I'm like, is it only just because I can find the Beyond Burger in more places now? Is it only because it seems like there's just more vegan options all over the place? And like, I want to think, isn't that a reflection of this consumer demand? But the fact that, as you cited, the number of animals being killed just keeps going up. So it's almost like those two things don't seem compatible to me. I don't know if you have any insight into why does it feel like veganism is so much more mainstream now, yet our numbers just remain relatively stagnant.
Yeah, I think there's a great poll by Faunalytics. I think it came out in 2014, but to me, like, that's the biggest poll I've seen. Like, I think they polled like 12,000 people in the United States, which is, from what I've seen, is pretty massive. And I'm no statistician or whatever, but I mean, I'm kind of an idiot when it comes to math, but which is probably not a good thing to admit. But their poll is really interesting to me because they polled 12,000 people. They polled vegans, they polled vegetarians, but they also polled people that were our former vegans and vegetarians and asked them why they went vegan and why they aren't vegan anymore. And those answers, I think, are really interesting. And if I remember correctly, it came out that like basically people were vegan for approximately 1 year, maybe to 7 years before they stopped being vegan. Majority of the people became vegan or vegetarian for health reasons. And most of the people became vegan and vegetarian or left vegan and vegetarianism because it was too difficult and basically because the community felt a little weird. To me, that's super telling, right? That just seems like such a nail in the coffin for the idea of vegan outreach as a tactic and a strategy. But I also think it's important because it kind of indicates that people are going vegan and vegetarian for health, which is fine. Not eating animals is not eating animals. But I do think that like, and you hear this all the time, well, I go into my grocery store and there's vegan products everywhere. And that's true. But who are they catering to? I don't think vegans are the ones that pushed companies to create these products. And I don't think that a majority of the people eating them are vegan. And I also think that the people who created this stuff, with a couple of exceptions, I don't think they created it with, you know, a vegan ethic in mind, with, of course, a big shout out to Tofurky, who I think still holds it down. But I mean, but if you can look at like these large companies that are like making these vegan products and then they're selling them off for millions and millions and millions of dollars. To me, that's very telling that they're in it for the money, which, you know, whatever, to each their own. But like to argue that like veganism is winning because there's so many vegan products out there, I just don't think it's true. I think it's because it's a fad right now. It's a bit of a trend. It is a healthier way to eat. And there's money to be made off of it. And so to me, that's why I think there's so many vegan products out there. But I also think to a certain extent, there is like a bit of an echo chamber. Like, of course, in the United States, there's amazing vegan food. And you go into any city in the United States and you go to a grocery store, you're going to find amazing vegan food. But, you know, try driving across the United States, you know, from the West Coast to East Coast and try eating vegan along the way. It's really hard. Like, there's not like vegan options everywhere. There's not, you know, vegan food pouring out of every grocery store. It just feels that way because most of us are people that live in urban areas and shop at places that have those kind of options. And so I think it gives us the perception that our world, our bubble that we live in is very vegan friendly, and it is. But I think once we pop that vegan bubble, I think like it'll be a bit of an eye opener.
And so talking a little bit more about strategy now. So you have your YouTube channel, The Cranky Vegan. One of the series that you, which I guess will come as no surprise to people that are listening to this conversation, but one of the series you do is called Are We Winning? And so, yeah. One, I suggest everyone go and watch all your videos because they're, one, you put a little more effort into your videos than I think the average vlogger does. Just like the visual flair or whatever. It's all good stuff. But in the Are We Winning series, you tackle that from a number of angles, but I'm wondering, like, what would you say is our metric? Is it the number of vegans that are out there, or is there some other way that you would measure if, as a movement, we are winning, and how do you sort of quantify that?
I think it's really important to ask that question. Like, and that's how I ended up starting this YouTube channel, was like, people would always post these things and they say, we're winning. And I'm like, and my response always, and maybe it's because I'm cranky and a skeptic, is like, are we winning? Like, are you sure we're winning? Because it certainly doesn't seem that way. And I'm sure it feels good to say it, but like, you know, every animal rights conference, you know, AR 2000 and whatever, there's always a keynote speaker and they always say the same thing. We're reaching this tipping point. And I'm just like, tipping point for what? Like, I just don't see it. And to me, like, the measure of success in our movement is that the movement is growing, not just in size, but in its politics, to where we're not so much of a single issue movement anymore. And I think that's super important. I think we measure it by successes in our campaigns. And I think we measure it by eventually, and it's a large number, but like animals being killed. And maybe that's a real broad metric to look at. And maybe that's not totally like a fair metric to look at. But that is the ultimate goal of the animal rights movement, is to reduce the number of animals killed every year to zero. And we have to figure out smart ways and strategic ways to get from whatever the crazy number is, 57 billion, 75 billion, whatever it is, animals killed every year, and reducing that to zero. That's like a monumental task. And so I think it is critical that we slow down every once in a while and ask those questions and figure out how we determine if we are winning and if we're moving in the right direction. And I think there's a lot of value in that. And I think it's something we don't do nearly enough, if at all, in the animal rights movement. But I think that is another way that we can measure success, beyond just counting the number of animals being killed, is just seeing what our movement is evolving into, and how strategic it's becoming, and how it's, or if it's becoming, a piece in the broader movement for social justice. Or are we just going to continue to be this standalone movement off in the corner that everyone thinks is weird? And I think if we can shift all those pieces, then I think that's a good way to measure our success. But also, I think like we can't do those things alone. And I think like the success of a movement relies on like engaging and believing in the idea of collective liberation, that all the movements are connected in one way or the other, and that we should all support. I don't think we will be successful as a movement by just focusing on our one goal of reducing the animals killed every year to zero. Because I do think that's a bit of an impossible task. Like, I think there are always going to be an animal, human or non-human, that's going to be oppressed or killed for the benefit of others. And if we can't work towards that goal with other movements, then I think we are failing.
And so I was watching a speech that you did a while ago, and you said individuals eating animals isn't the problem, it's the symptom. And I'm wondering if you could expand on that.
No. Yeah. I think like we spend so much time as a movement, like focusing on the individual, like this person's an asshole because he's or she's not vegan, or like this person stopped being vegan, they're a terrible person, or like I stood outside in the cold and the rain and handed out flyers and I got three people to consider vegan. Like, what difference does that matter really at the end of the day? Like, it's really not changing anything, unfortunately. I know that we all want it to, but I just don't think it is. And we focus on the meat eater, the person that's consuming animals, as the main problem and the main focus, when really they're just the symptom of a much bigger problem. It's like when you get sick, you're not trying to stop the sniffle, you're trying to stop the infection inside the body. Otherwise, you're just going to remain sick forever. And that's how I kind of see how I kind of see the animal rights movement, is we focus so hard on stopping the sniffle that we never stop to like try to fix the infection. So I always look at it as like a tree. Like, if you were going to like remove a tree, chop it down, you're not going to start at the very top of the tree and start picking one leaf off at a time until you get to the bottom of the tree and hope that the tree just falls over. Like, you're going to dig up the roots, you're going to chop away at the trunk, and the rest falls. So I think that like when it comes to the idea of supply and demand, which vegan outreach as a standalone strategy suggests that if we affect demand so much that supply will change, I think that's a nearly impossible strategy. But if we flip it around and we go after the root problems instead of the individual, instead of the symptoms, and we start affecting supply, we don't have to worry about who may or may not want to eat animals, because there won't be any animals around to eat. And I think there's like some really good examples of like things like that happening, and ideas that revolve around that idea, like strategies that revolve around those ideas, that if you start affecting supply, you don't have to worry about the demand. And to me, that is the same thing as like, instead of worrying so much about the symptom, start worrying about the root problems. Change the root problems to change the main infection, the symptoms, or the leaves of this tree will change along with it. And to me, that's how I think we should be looking at our activism.
To me, that almost sort of brings up the chicken or the egg type of question, because I think some people would say, but if the demand is always there, regardless of the supply, like someone will figure out how to supply that thing. So I guess I'm wondering, like, what sorts of, do you have examples of types of campaigns that could, you think, effectively get at the supply chain? Like, do you think the tactics that were involved in the Shack campaign could be used against Tyson or something like that to like shut down Tyson, or like what do you sort of envision? I know that's like a really big question, but do you have any ideas of like what types of campaigns targeting supply could have these types of effects you're talking about?
Right. And just to reiterate, like these are just my opinions, right? Like I could be right, I could be totally wrong. So I just, you know, I throw these out there as ideas that I sit around and think about. But I think like interesting campaigns, and also I would like to say that like I think Shaq was very specific to its time. Like I don't think we can take Shaq and recreate it. Like it wouldn't work. But I do think there are really smart ways that we can do strategic pressure campaigns to change corporations and change communities and societies that we could work on. And I think a lot of movements around the world, most movements around the world, focus primarily on pressure campaigns to make change. And they're a lot more successful than we are in the animal rights movement. But that being said, I think some like interesting ideas, you know, for instance, the United States with subsidies, like the food systems in the United States and animal agriculture is so subsidized, and that's how it's affordable. But what happens if you ran a campaign where you got rid of, you know, subsidies in the United States? Meat would be incredibly expensive. Like I just don't think most people would be able to afford eating animals anymore. I think that is an interesting step forward. I think there was a couple, maybe a year ago, there was a Kentucky Fried Chicken in England had like shifted all of their like supply to this one company that, you know, like trucking company that was going to ship all the frozen chicken out from their main source out to all the Kentucky Fried Chickens in England. And something happened with that company where something with their refrigeration units broke or something like that. But overnight, like 560 Kentucky Fried Chickens shut down for multiple days until like this one company got their shipping back in order. And right now, like with the SAFE movement, people love to go stand in front of slaughterhouses and watch these poor animals be sent in to be slaughtered, and stand in front of trucks and use that as some sort of strategy that I don't fully understand. But what happens if instead of standing and disrupting trucks going into slaughterhouses, what happens if you were like, you found an important key supplier or a trucking company that was supplying large restaurants or industries, and you started doing demonstrations outside of their trucking facilities and started gumming up those works? Like, you could shut down, in theory, you could shut down like 550 Kentucky Fried Chickens overnight if you could just stop the supply. So to me, that sounds like an interesting like tertiary targeting example of like, instead of going after like trying to shut down Kentucky Fried Chicken and Yum Foods who owns it, like you can just shut down the people that are delivering the chickens to it. More than likely, these are much smaller, you know, trucking corporations that are not used to protests and campaigns like that. And so I don't know, it's like, it, to me, it's just like thinking outside the box a little and figuring out creative ways that you could disrupt these industries, instead of just trying to convince people one at a time to change the way that they possibly eat, and hope that they stick with it long enough to make a difference.
So do you think that strategically moving forward, that as a movement, it would be beneficial to just abandon sort of the vegan education arm of the movement altogether? Or is there some sort of balance of the two? Like how would you envision those working together or just separating them entirely?
I think education is super important, and I'm not trying to dismiss it, but I think the animal rights movement and the grassroots scene, like education is relied on almost entirely as the only tactic moving forward. For a variety of reasons, I think is a whole other discussion. But I think education is a really critical piece. And so like, you know, with the Shaq campaign, for instance, we did a lot of educational outreach and we educated people about the laboratory. And, you know, people were really concerned about these puppy dogs and the kittens inside this laboratory that are being abused and killed, and rightfully so. And so that way we were able to look past veganism as a moral baseline. And we were able to build our movement to be bigger and bigger and bigger and stronger and stronger and stronger because we allowed anyone who wanted to shut down this laboratory to be involved in that campaign. So vegans, vegetarians, omnivores, the whole gamut. And that worked really in our favor. But at the same time, with those education outreach pieces about the cats and the dogs in the laboratories, we'd also talk to people about the chickens and the cows and the pigs and educate them about veganism and vegetarianism and the importance of animal issues and the horrifying conditions that animals are stuck in other places besides laboratories. And I think that starts to click. Like, I do believe that, like, if we abandon this moral baseline, we're going to be able to build a much bigger and broader movement and still use education to change people's hearts and minds, but at the same time also be able to move corporations and industries. Because, like, you can make someone become vegan, but if they become vegan, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be an activist for animals. But if you can create an activist for animals, I think eventually the pieces start falling into place and it clicks and they will become vegan. There are, you know, people really love to dismiss people that aren't vegan and disregard their work and their activism because they're not vegan. But there are amazing, amazing activists and individuals around the world just doing like incredible work. And we dismiss all of it because of the choices they make when they sit down to eat a meal. And that just seems like such a huge lost opportunity. So I think if we start building those bridges by letting down our guard a bit on our moral baseline around veganism, and then, you know, use education as like a secondary piece to our campaigns, I think it's like a twofer. You know, we get to like start reshaping or shutting down corporations and at the same time growing vegans. But just simply growing vegans, it's not really done anything in terms of affecting industry.
All right. Well, I think that's probably a good place to leave it off. Jake, so the Cranky Vegan on YouTube, what other social media or any websites or anything you would point people towards if they want to follow along with your work?
Yeah, YouTube. Come watch me be cranky and be irritated and talk about all this stuff at length. It's the Cranky Vegan. I'm also on Instagram, mostly being cranky about vegan food, how I wish it was better, even though it's amazing. But you got to be cranky about something. And I'm on Facebook, like everyone, just surprisingly being cranky there as well. So if you really enjoy ornery white men, the Cranky Vegan's the place for you.
Perfect. Awesome. Thank you so much for talking with me today, Jake.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on.
All right, Paul. So you were not present for the interview, but you have heard the interview, correct?
That is correct. Listen to it this morning, Andy.
That is good. That is good. So I thought it'd be cool to talk about this news story having heard said interview, because I feel like this is actually a good example of what Jake is talking about in terms of strategic campaigning and how it might fall short a little bit of the getting everybody to go vegan goal, but still has a lot of tangible benefits. So I feel like maybe you should read this one so we can get your great impression in there.
All right. So this is from Plant-Based News, titled Plant-Based Brooklyn Borough. Andy?
Maybe Ruby Dog should read the headline.
Yes. Go for it.
Plant-based Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams launches citywide school meatless Mondays.
Thank you. All right, I'll take it from here. All New York City public schools will have meatless Mondays beginning in the 2019 to 2020 school year under a scheme developed by Mayor Bill de Blasio, School Chancellor Richard A. Carranza. Oh, no, he doesn't have as good of it. He definitely has an Italian name, but not as good. Let me start it over. Under a scheme developed by Mayor Bill de Blasio, School Chancellor Richard A. Carranza, and vegan Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams. The initiative, which was first piloted in 15 schools in Brooklyn in spring 2018, will provide students with healthy, all-vegetarian breakfast and lunch menus every Monday.
So, Paul, I think that this is pretty cool. I know we've sort of talked about the downfalls of the Meatless Monday campaign before. This is almost different than that, because this is something that's sort of being, I know this has like a negative connotation, but forced upon a number of students, 1.1 million students every year to be specific. And I kind of want to talk about how this sort of relates to what Jake has been talking about. And so, Paul, I need your help with this math. Tell me if you think this is all correct, if this is a good way of thinking about this. So this is going to come to play in about like 18 months or so, right? And then 1.1 million students will partake in Meatless Mondays. So the school year for these schools is about 10 months, right? And that means that there's four Mondays per month. That's 40 Mondays. All good so far?
I suppose. I feel like sometimes there's more or less Mondays, but
there's a wiggle room. Let's say a wiggle room of like five Mondays or something like that. Okay. Anyway, times 1.1 million students, that equals just for lunch alone. Now, because apparently this is for lunch and breakfast, but I'm not entirely sure if every student's eating breakfast. I know when I was going to school, everybody ate the lunch and some kids were doing their breakfast. So let's just talk about the lunch. That equals 44 million meals that are going to be meatless now, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that means that if you divide that by three meals in a day, that equals 14.6 million full days of vegetarian eating. And you divide that by 365 days, that equals basically a little over 40,000 people going vegetarian just based off of these meals being served alone. How do you feel about that math?
I feel pretty good about that. I think obviously, like we already pointed out with the Monday things, but then also, you know, if someone is going to eat more than just three meals a day, most people have snacks as well. So you're not taking into factor those. And then the last thing I want to point out is that, which I think this warrants maybe a further discussion, is I imagine that students still have the option to bring in their own non-vegetarian or non-vegan lunch. So it's not going to be all 1.1 million students eating a vegetarian lunch. However, that being said, however, whatever the number is, like I'm sure they do, each individual school does some sort of analysis about roughly how many students eat the lunch, and then that's what they use to then order the food that they need to supply that many students. And I think maybe a more accurate calculation, not that we're going to be able to get this, would be you take like that number of meals that they specifically know they need to prepare, because they're like, this is how many students we need to get food for, because not every student's buying lunch. And that day, like there's one less day where they will be buying non-vegetarian food. So I feel like that's the big change right there, is that they are not ordering for that one day, which then times, you know, however many students, however many days, however many meals, like that's what's going to make the difference. And even if it's not the equivalent of 40,000 people, I do still think it will be very significant. And I imagine it will probably have some impact on the meat industry, I hope.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we could say it has like some huge impact on like the meat industry in general, but I do think that, you know, the effort that would have to go into convincing 40,000 people, even if it's half that, 20,000 people, to go vegetarian for a year. Now, again, of course, this is not vegan. It's not exactly where we want it to be, but I still think it's an important thing to recognize that this isn't even like, we don't even have to convince people to do anything. It's just the option that's being presented to them like default, and that, you know, how many people, you know, it took me what, like two years of touring, or like three or four tours on the 10 million lives tour, to have 10,000 individual conversations and so about to people about why they should go vegan after watching a video about the treatment of animals on farms, and like the amount of money, like the salary I had to get paid and the gas that we used and the you know, the resources and finding volunteers and all of that stuff is like being accomplished. Not that this just happened like in the blink of an eye. Obviously there was an immense campaign behind it, but like the probably doing way more good than anything that I did, spending years on the road educating people about going vegan, is all being done just with the stroke of a pen that is now signing this thing into action.
Yeah. And I think, I imagine this will hopefully have some effect on promoting this sort of eating even when they're not eating it on Mondays, you know, like hopefully this takes off either for this specific child or for the family or for the school. Like maybe some schools will be like, oh, wow, this is actually really great and working out really well. Let's do it 2 days a week or let's do it 3 days a week or something like that. I don't know if that's going to happen, but I can't imagine, Andy, that when you implement something like this to 1.1 million students, that zero of them are going to be impacted positively, you know, in that sort of way.
Yeah. And I think that one of the things that we sort of talk about when we talk about these initiatives, which is it's different than sort of trying to convince the individual public to, as a whole, adopt Meatless Monday, that this is something that they're going to be eating what the school gives them, regardless of if they choose, you know, if they make the choice to eat that thing. And this is sort of like becoming like the de facto thing. That this is something that has an impact because it is something people don't generally have a choice over anyway. So if you don't have to convince them to do anything other than just keep eating the food that is going to be served to them, it feels like it's like a worthy use of time.
And I think, you know, I imagine, because Andy, I know how high school students, or at least high school students, I know how they think. I imagine there will be plenty of those 1.1 million students who will be like, oh, I can't believe we have to eat vegan vegetarian meals on Mondays, blah, 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 blah. But then it's like this, I imagine this will become the norm. And it's like those jokes will fall off and it will just become the thing that happens every Monday. And I think there is something to be said about eating vegetarian or not eating meat becoming the norm, even if it's just for one day to start out with. You know, it's like you get over those jokes, you get over the fact that it's a weird thing to do. And I think that that's also a valuable step towards a more vegan world.
Yeah, definitely. I think we can't discount the fact that people will be exposed to hopefully tasty meat alternatives. And hopefully that is like another step in normalizing, at least if not vegan eating, meat-free eating. I mean, I guess I wouldn't be surprised knowing that the vegan Brooklyn Borough president, Eric Adams, is, you know, one of the biggest champions and really one of the biggest proponents behind this thing, if there isn't a push to get some of the meals to be fully vegan. But, you know, I guess that's only speculation that we can make. But the fact that it is getting people to try stuff and realize that it's not horrible, hopefully, I mean, I don't know. School cafeteria food's never been amazing, right? But it feels like if it's as long as it's not any worse than the food that they've been served, I think that could also have a positive impact as well towards getting people to take that sort of individual step on their own as well.
Yeah, Andy, it's kind of like I don't know where I fall exactly with what I want the food to be, because I mean, obviously I would want it to be all vegan. In my ideal situation, that's what it would be. But the fact that they say it's healthy, all vegetarian breakfast, leads me to believe it's not the, from my recollection in middle school, the cheesy breadstick dunkers, which were just breadsticks covered in cheese that you would dunk in tomato sauce, which were a marinara sauce, absolutely delicious. But I imagine one of the worst things that I could possibly be ingesting into my body. Would 100% eat one now, a vegan version of it, but that's besides the point. Like, if it's that, like, part of me is like, well, I hope it's that, because then kids are going to be like, wow, this food is freaking awesome. This tastes great. Or some other, you know, like, good, delicious vegan food that's not necessarily, you know, like a raw vegan thing. The fact that they say it's going to be healthy, I'm sort of worried that it's going to be like, you know, the what was that Super Bowl ad? What was the thing that they made fun of vegans for at the dinner party? The person was like, oh, I have this thing.
Beet loaf.
I forget what it was. Yes. Yeah. Like, I hope that it's not that, because I'm like, oh, kids are going to hate that. So I want it to be this in between where it's like, it's not this super healthy raw vegan thing that we've spent the last 17 episodes talking about how that probably isn't the best way of promoting veganism. I hope it's not that, but I also hope it's not, you know, something that's awful for kids, because I think it is unfair to force upon students terrible food.
Yeah, definitely. So assuming that the food is tasty and the students like it, I think that it could have a ripple effect. And, you know, like, I guess one of the biggest theme of the interview was essentially that the vegan movement is wasting time trying to convince individuals to go vegan, and that there's a lot more that we could do. We could spend our time better if we were focusing on like larger campaigns. And that is something that I wrestle with, because as we've talked about in previous episodes, when I'm thinking about big picture stuff, it often feels overwhelming. And I'm like, well, I'm good at talking to people about veganism, and if I just keep my head down and do the work, like that's my weight that I can pull in this movement as an ally to these animals. And then you hear stuff like what Jake's saying, and you're kind of like, and I don't think Jake is saying abandon that entirely, but you know, you're kind of like, oh, am I just like wasting my time? Should I go out petitioning for something else or campaigning for something else? And I think that we definitely will have a future episode that's asking like, is contemporary vegan activism dead? Because there's been a few other news stories sort of pointing towards that, some high profile figures saying things along those lines that I'd love to dive into. But I think that this could potentially be an example of something that where like the strategic campaigning aids in also potentially creating individual change. And you know, all of the stuff we're saying is obviously pure speculation, but knowing that this could result in people trying meat-free meals and realizing that they're pretty tasty and can keep them fueled for the day can open people up to going vegetarian and maybe potentially vegan depending on the meals that they're serving. How do you feel about that?
Well, Andy, can I just, I want to bring up one, I'm going to ignore the question that you just asked me because you made me think of something else that, it does relate to what you said. It does relate to what you said in the interview with Jake, because there is definitely this sense when I was listening to the interview where it's like, to some extent he was saying, oh, and once we were kind of, we had this target, we kind of accepted the different ways that people wanted to go after this target. And we would like the different things that people would do, whether that was, you know, like the physical, physical damage, not to the humans, but to like the structures or releasing animals or economic damage, maybe I should say. And then there was like the going into the buildings or protesting outside. And he was kind of saying like, we accepted the different ways that people wanted to go after them. And that kind of attitude to me was kind of saying like, oh, however people wanted to do this, like we would still promote them, which is the attitude that we see sometimes that Andy, you and I are usually critical of, which is like, no matter what you're doing, if it's for animals, then it's good. But then to counter that, Jake was also saying, also went into how much thought goes into which targets they picked, because he was talking about, like they wanted to go after this one company, and to go after the company, they went after like the banks that invested in that company and like all the different bigger organizations who, if they lost that one client, it wouldn't be a big deal for them. But if that one client lost them, it was a huge deal. So it's like, there was so much thought that went into that the choices of who to do. So I just thought it was kind of this interesting, almost, not paradox, almost duality, maybe, of these two different things, where it's like, on one end, we accept all forms of activism, and on the other end, the types, the who we're going after is so thought out. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying. I'm struggling to understand why that came after the question I asked you, though.
I think it might have been because something you said at the beginning made me think of that. And then what was the question, Andy? What was the question? I'll answer the question.
That's a good question, Paul. It's been so long since I asked it that I have forgotten.
Sorry, Andy. I really wanted to get that out there.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I was probably, if I had to guess, I was asking something about like, do we think traditional activism is dead? But you know, you could just go ahead and ignore that as well.
but, I guess how that relates to this article specifically is, even though I guess, yeah, it's like, I guess this is not the traditional go out and convince people to go vegetarian or convince people to go vegan. It's more so, you know, like a targeted area that was probably suspected of being more susceptible to something like this. Like, I'm sure there are plenty of other places in the United States that at this point in time would never even consider something like Meatless Mondays. So it was certainly a like a targeted area. And this is definitely a tactic that I think many vegans are not a big fan of, because it's, you know, I guess it's not, because it's not promoting full veganism. But yeah, I mean, this is certainly something that you and I believe both think is a good thing, is a positive step.
Yeah. And I think that the interview with Jake sort of reframes how we might be thinking about this particular campaign. So I'm excited to use Jake's framework as we sort of move forward with future episodes of the show.
Me too, Andy. Me too. It was, yeah, I really liked that interview. It was very well done. He's also very good at like talking.
Sure is. And as I said in the interview, definitely go follow along, especially on the YouTube, the Cranky Vegan there. The production value on the videos is just another level. It's not just someone sitting in a room talking at a camera. It's very entertaining in addition to the well thought out content as well. So definitely go check that out. All right, Paul, let's get this back on track and okay, sort of bring it back to sort of the content of the interview. As I mentioned, it's been a lot of what was talked about is stuff that I kind of struggle with. So this is something that you hear from people. This is something you hear from people who are not vegan when you're doing activism. At least I've heard this from a lot of people, like, well, you can't convince everybody to go vegan. And my response is usually like, well, what about you? Will you go vegan? You know, like, let's not talk about what everybody's doing. And so it's sort of something that's kind of, it's kind of like when a non-vegan criticizes PETA and you're like, I agree, but also you have to go vegan before you can make those criticisms kind of thing. And so hearing that from like a vegan, that's like, we're not going to convince everybody to go vegan, was like, okay, all right, I hear you. And it's one of those things where you're kind of like, if I agree with this, do I have to just totally change how I approach my advocacy? And I don't know, what did you think when you were hearing that brought up in the interview?
I think my first instinct is to resist it, is to be like, no, this is the thing that's going to, like, we should be working towards making this vegan world, you know? And I think I'm pretty good at you know, putting those opinions aside and listening to what the person has to say and feel out whether or not I then have to reevaluate my own thinking. But at the same time, it's like, if we didn't have the dedicated ethical vegans, I doubt that this, to bring it back to the article, I doubt that something like this would have happened if there were not dedicated vegans pushing for this. Like, I could be wrong, but I don't think something like this Meatless Mondays would happen if it was just people who were like, oh yeah, I only eat meat once a week. Like, that doesn't seem like something that you would then go out and champion that cause and go through probably a terrible amount of like legal stuff and all these things that I have no idea about to put something like this into action. It's like, that took a lot of effort and a lot of work from a lot of people. And I imagine that not all of them, but I imagine that many of the people, probably especially the ones at the core of it, are either like ethical vegans or at least vegetarian. Because this sort of seems like the type of thing where it's like, I know that the world is not ready to go vegan right this second. So I'm going to like put that ask out there and then settle for the, like, what I can get right now. And what they could get right now is Meatless Mondays, you know? But I guess my point is that like, if there wasn't people creating these vegans, it's almost like a chicken or the egg thing, the chicken and the just egg. It's like, if they didn't have the vegans, then these sorts of things, I don't think would be happening as much. And even if like in the interview, even if these actions are happening and there's non-vegans working toward them too, which is fine, like Jake points out, I imagine the people that are at the core organizing them are probably vegan, because this is a big enough issue to them that they're willing to put that much effort and that much time into it, you know? So it's like, we still need those people.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely the chicken or the just egg thing is definitely something that, you know, I brought that up in the interview, and that's what I struggle with. And so I don't think, you know, Jake was saying abandon individual change advocacy altogether, but that we're sort of missing out on like a huge potential if we're not also engaging in these targeted campaigns. If we only think that the only way to change is to talk to every single person in the world and get them to see the light. So like, I think that you are right in that often the ethical vegans are the center points of these types of campaigns. And I think that we need like all, it takes all kinds kind of thing. You know, I think that we need both. I think that if there's just strategic campaigning and there's not sort of a movement of people that are dedicated to providing vegan education for people, that I think that it will inevitably fail, you know? And, you know, because like, I guess the thing that I kind of struggled with, and I talked about this in the interview, is, you know, that my assumption, my version of the chicken and the egg is that we need everyone to go vegan before we can take down a lot of these big corporations. And Jake is sort of saying that it's almost like the opposite of that, that it is kind of like, well, if we can just affect the supply, then we can affect the demand. And I feel like it's like both things at the same time need to be worked on.
Yeah. No, I do think that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, like almost the purpose of having Jake on the show and like for Jake to push so hard for the corporate campaigning and strategic campaigns and whatnot is because we do need some voices in this movement that are like, listen, it's cool that you want to do vegan education work, but also we're missing out on so many opportunities by not also engaging in these other forms of activism.
I think that makes perfect sense. It was a great interview, and I think it was an important perspective to bring on. So, Andy, thank you for doing that interview.
Well, Paul, I think we can leave it there. I will say that if anyone was really interested by this interview, I would say go back and listen to our live in Atlantic City episode where we had Lauren Ornelas from Food Empowerment Project on talking all about corporate campaigns. There's a little bit more of the how in that episode, but also some of the why. And I think that would make a really good companion to this episode. So definitely go check that out. And you can always send your thoughts into us by emailing thebeardedvegans@gmail.com. Again, we got that mailbag episode coming up. So we want your questions, even if they're not related to this episode. Talk about anything, even the technical aspects of the podcast to the biggest possible overall big picture question about veganism. We want to hear it all from you. We appreciate all the feedback that we do get. So again, thebeardedvegans@gmail.com.
So Andy, I know last week at the time of this recording, it has not happened yet. I'm sure you had a fantastic time at the Andy Veg Fest, but do you have anything else coming up?
Yes, I do. This coming weekend, again, I'll be at the Nashville Veg Fest, Nashville, Tennessee. That's April 6th. And I'll be speaking with JL Fields all about food and body shaming at noon. Weekend after that, April 14th, Michiana Veg Fest, South Bend, Indiana. April 28th, Veg Fest, Michigan, Novi, Michigan. And come stop by the Compassion Company table and say, what's up, Beardo? And I'll hook you up with the Beard Vegan sticker. So hope to see you there.
Andy, I feel like it's been so long since I've done a Veg Fest, and specifically so long since I've done a Veg Fest with you, and that makes me so sad.
I know. It's been quite a while. Looking at this schedule, it feels like it will continue to be quite a while.
So, no!
I know. That's sad. I mean, I could send you out and do some if you want, but
I probably don't have time for that.
Exactly.
As I was saying that, I was like, I don't know if this would be the best idea, but I really do miss it, Andy. I miss you.
I miss you. I miss you more than I miss doing VegFest with you. But all that said, Paul, I liked all this talk about strategic campaigning, and I think it's really important. But I do appreciate that I will never have to strategically campaign to get you to say the following 7 words.
We are the Bearded Vegans, signing off.
Unless you consider me saying that part of a strategic campaign.
Uh-oh.
I was wary of eating something that's like, some car just honked at me.